This is an interview with Tara Edmondson, who is being interviewed about her role as a State Gardens Manager, Office of the Governor, Government House, Hobart, a position she has held since 2019, having first joined the gardening team there in 2004. The interview is taking place on Monday, 21st of March, 2022, in the Conservatory at Government House, and as part of the Australian Garden History Society's National Oral History Program. The interviewer is Jean Elder, and our sound recorder is Rhonda Hamilton. Tara, can you please state your full name and date of birth?
Tara Mary Edmondson, born on the 20th of August 1979.
Wow. So you grew up on Tasmania's east coast in the town of Orford, and you describe your childhood as being one of lots of outdoor exploring coastlines and lots of bushwalking. Can you tell us more about these early days and what your gardening family and gardening friends were at that point?
Yeah, that's correct. I grew up in Orford on Tasmania's east coast, from a large family of one of five children. And yeah, we've spent so much of our time outdoors, particularly on the beaches. My father's a very keen fisherman. We spent a lot of time in the bays around Tryabunna and exploring Maria Island. My parents were keen gardeners. They had no formal qualifications, but they built two homes in Orford, and they, you know, very hands-on. They did everything. My dad was involved with, you know, putting up fences and laying driveways, and my mum had a natural ability to design gardens, and she had quite a flair for, you know, plant selection. And yeah, they laid out some lovely gardens there in Orford. But I think the biggest horticultural influence in my early childhood came from family friends who lived in Tryabunna, Gwen and Puck Vaughan. During the school holidays, we would spend a lot of time at their house. They were had a large property, self-sufficient. They grew a lot of produce for their own family and friends. And also, they had extensive ornamental gardens as well. Gwen was very keen on growing cut flowers. They had a small vineyard. Gwen was also a landscape artist, and we would often go on walks into the bushland or again on the coast, and she would paint scenes. We'd also collect orchids from time to time, and she would take those home to create botanical illustrations of those. So they were absolutely my motivation, I think, and my inspiration behind pursuing a career in horticulture. I think they drew my attention to small details and encouraged, you know, observation of the environment.
Mm-hmm. And obviously your love of cut flowers and growing fruit and veggies.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So beginning your horticultural career, in 2000 you began an apprenticeship with the City of Hobart. Tell us about that.
That's right. So I was very keen early on to pursue a career as a gardener. I had prior to working in the industry, I was working in hospitality, and I started some evening classes. I then, in around the summer of 98-99, did some work for a local wholesale nursery, and that really sort of cemented, you know, the choice that I'd made, and I was very keen to pursue further education. And at that time, an apprenticeship with the Hobart City Council was offered, and I was, yeah, fortunate enough to get that job. And it was based in their nursery, actually, in Warrain, and we grew all of the street trees, annual bedding plants, ornamentals, perennials for the parks and gardens throughout the City of Hobart. So it was a great introduction, and a variety of plants we were growing there, which, yeah, introduced me to so many wonderful plants and again inspiring me to continue further. Mm. Yeah, I was also given the opportunity whilst working there to do some work within the town hall, working as an urban vegetation officer from time to time, and that offered a different perspective on the role of the council, and I was able to be involved with some street tree planning and also taking a few complaints from ratepayers, you know, with overhanging vegetation issues and those types of daily you know, interactions that the council have with the general public.
Was the significant tree register established at that time, or that came later?
It was established at that time.
Yeah, in terms of trying to protect trees over the significant trees in Hobart, including the trees here, I think, of Government House, because then they get lodged on the local government planning scheme as well, which affords them greater protection than just being listed somewhere.
That's correct. So the introduction of the significant tree register was to raise awareness around the significance of trees and their importance within the urban environment, and they've attached that to the Hobart City Council's building application process, and that was a really important thing, I thought, for the Government House estate to be registered with. And so we've been working on that over the last 12 months, identifying particular significant trees, those of significant age and size, but also unusual varieties, species that aren't common within the Hobart area. And we're sort of moving through that process now, and hopeful that we can have quite a few of our trees. We have over 400 mature trees here, and many of them would align with the criteria that meets the significance.
Trees.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Before coming to asking you about when you joined the garden staff at Government House, I thought I might just introduce a little the House and Gardens. The Government House and Gardens in Hobart have been described as one of the best examples of 19th century English landscaping in Australia. And now, 165 years after the gardens were first laid out by William Thomas, they feature avenues dominated by mature evergreen trees, and as you've described, Tara, over 400 mature trees, with vistas to the River Derwent and the lake, which was originally the quarry site for the sandstone used in building Government House, a neo-Gothic style early Victorian country house. The gardens, as we look around, still retain the elements of a country estate with surrounding paddocks, formal gardens, kitchen garden, and a flower picking garden, and much more. So in 2004, Tara, you were employed as the first female gardener at the Office of the Governor. This must have been a very exciting time for you as a young woman to join the gardening team. Tell us that. Take yourself back to 2004. What was it like? What was the first things you got involved in at this time?
Yeah, it was an exciting time. My apprenticeship with the Hobart City Council had finished, and it was their practice to then introduce new apprentices into their educational programs. So the job I got here was, yeah, well timed, and yeah, I was couldn't wait to get started. Actually, the role was primarily in the food production area, but I was also involved with cut flowers, and one of the areas that I had to look after was a rose garden. And then, in addition, I did work in the quarry pond gardens as well, maintaining the ornamental beds there.
So how many gardeners were there at that time when you joined?
At that time, I think there would have been seven gardeners. And at that time, in contrast to now, all of the gardeners were employed full time. And So, yeah, the...
Describe the kind of routine that happened then, or... And you said you were in charge of some of the productive garden and the rose garden. Were there roles assigned?
It's always been the case that gardeners quite independently manage their areas, and then from time to time when there is, larger project work, we get together and do teamwork. Steve Percival was the garden manager at that time, and the garden, actually, when I took over, there hadn't been anyone in that role for around 6 months. So, as you can imagine, there was a lot to be done. There was, organising of new plantings to be done, to prepare the beds, and talking with the kitchen to liaise and find out the types of foods that they were, wanting to receive and the types of quantities as well. There's always been food production on the Government House estate, and that has evolved sort of depending on the demands of the kitchen, but also the community more broadly. The garden bed that I took over is still in that current position, was moved in the 1980s, and it was during a period of sort of rationalisation, and where traditionally Government House would have produced large quantities of staple type produce, potatoes, carrots, peas and brassicas, we've now moved to growing a much larger range of produce and in smaller quantities that the kitchen can, can cope with, as they've got confined spaces as well as there and storage ability. So.
Mm-hmm. Because historically the gardens have produced for all sorts of occasions. The patriotic garden was used during the war, was that right?
That's correct. At the during the Second World War, the Western paddock, which runs along the boundary of the Lower Domain Road, was in produce to assist in the war relief. The gardens have also provided food and still continue to provide food for community organisations, charitable groups, and we were able to continue that during this COVID-19 pandemic. Excess produce that we had as a result of reduced functions and events at Government House itself were able to be distributed out to the community.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's great. The gardens, in terms of changing sustainable horticultural practice, what has happened of recent? I'm thinking more of climate change and how that's impacting on the garden. Does that mean different ways of working?
That involves quite various elements. We are conscious of the climate change and needing to improve some of our practices, and that has included the types of products that we use on the site, moving towards softer chemical applications and combining cultural and biological controls in conjunction with softer chemical applications. We've been renovating the food production space, particularly over the last 5 years, to include soil regeneration, that area having been used for decades, the soil's quite exhausted. So we're trying to add a lot of nutrient value biologicals back into the soil there, resting and cover cropping and those types of practices in that space as well. There is a need, as we think about planning towards the future, to perhaps increase our canopy cover, and particularly the area that we're looking at over the Eastern Arboretum towards the Tasman Bridge here. That space has been in my mind for development sort of into the near future. We've recently installed an irrigation system. Historically, there was no irrigation in that space, and we were dragging around sprinklers and hoses to try and establish new plantings. So we now have an irrigation system there which covers the plantings that we have already, and of course we can add on to that as we increase the plantings. I'd like to think that we can start with a sort of natural native type planting closer to the highway and River Derwent and bring that back to the exotic plantings that we currently have.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the horticultural practices, do you using those biological, the insects and things to control scale or any of that, like ladybird bugs to eat the white fly and things like that? Do you do any of those?
We haven't purchased insects with the purpose of of pest control, but the using less chemicals and encouraging sort of cultural practices of course builds up the beneficial insects, and that's what we've been trying to do.
Yes, that's the approach.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to just ask you about the visitors over the years. You've had many famous visitors come to the gardens, including the Queen, who came and planted the two magnificent blue gums, one of which has suffered a little, but they're still going strong, and they were planted in 1954 or 63.
Her Majesty the Queen has been here three times. We have an oak on the main drive that was planted in 53. In the 54. In 1963, they visited with Prince Philip and planted two eucalypts on our southern terrace. They are quite dominating in the view looking down the River Derwent. And then they were back again for our bicentenary and planted some native plants in our native garden, hewn pine and a blackwood and a myrtle.
Mm-hmm. And over the years, there have been some amusing incidents. Do you remember you describing once an ambassador visiting? Well, word had come that an ambassador was coming back to visit, but unfortunately the tree that had been planted earlier had suffered somewhat. Can you tell us that story?
That was an amusing story for the garden staff particularly. We had an important ambassador here. There was a lot of security around his visit, and we planted a tree actually into a pot under a marquee tent, which was then later planted out on the grounds. And the area that it was planted was particularly harsh, and perhaps in hindsight the plant chosen wasn't entirely appropriate, and it did suffer over a summer period with drought and eventually died. And we received notice that there would be another visit by this ambassador to Government House, and very quickly, we ran around and removed the sad dying tree and replaced it with a new one. And it was commented in his speech in the Government House ballroom during his visit that the tree was flourishing like our relationship with his home country.
Excellent. Well saved.
Yeah.
Now, I'd love to talk to you now about 2016, when you were instrumental in the design and construction of what is now known as La Haye's Garden at Government House. This being a recreation of the lost 18th century vegetable garden established at Research Bay by La Haye when the French expedition, under the command of Don Casto, I'll say it again, where he sheltered there after being blown off course in a fierce storm. Anyway, tell us about this project. How did it come about, and why did you choose the Eastern Paddock as a location for this garden?
Sure. The food production space during that and in the lead up to 2016, we had been developing and opening that space up to the public more for tours, and increasing the types of produce that we were growing and focusing a little bit on heirloom varieties. And previous governor, Professor Kate Warner, was really inspired and loved the research-based story of the French explorers coming here and planting out an experimental vegetable garden. And it was her that asked that we represent that piece of history here within the grounds of the estate. I'd certainly conscious at that time that I didn't want to impact on the existing landscape. One of our, you know, best attributes here in the garden is that it remains in its very original state, and I didn't want a French vegetable garden to impact on that. So we did choose an area on the estate that was sort of quite remote along the boundary on the east, sort of northeastern paddock with the botanical gardens, but it was still in line with our existing production spaces, so that ease of maintenance and tapping into irrigation systems, it was all very handy in that site.
Mm-hmm. And you laid it out with, in the French style, with four stone-walled gardens, is that...?
That's correct. There is some controversy around the alignment of the French vegetable garden at Research Bay, and if in fact what was discovered in 2003 during a process of getting World Heritage recognition of that site. The alignment that I chose to use was that was discovered by Bob Brown and other conservationists during that 2003 period and was reported to be the lost French garden of Research Bay. So that was what I chose to recreate here. But it is an imagined recreation. We don't have enough research available to be able to confirm all of the detail. The garden is, you know, it's quite small. It's just a modest vegetable garden. And we were able to represent other elements of the history of that site through the design. So not only do we have the stone alignment, the four quadrants depicted at Research Bay, but we were able to incorporate the interactions between the French explorers and the Aboriginal community, and we represented those by using native grasses that were common to that area, and we encircled those around the French vegetable garden. Many of those grasses were also collected by Le Billardier and La Haye and the other naturalists that were on Don Tricasto's expedition and taken back to Paris. So they're really important in terms of the herbarium specimens that were taken back and the collections that the French were able to depict.
That's great. And La Billardière ended up having one of the grasses.
Yeah, so common power.
Power.
We put just inside the fence as recognition of his role in the expedition.
Mm. And you sourced some French seeds to plant the actual vegetables?
That's correct. A really fascinating part of the story for me was the seed story. Tons of seed were brought here and broadcast sort of through other stops on the way to Research Bay. They were supplied by a company that still exists, Vilmorin Seed Company, and they supply agricultural quantities of seed throughout Europe. We were able to, through a recent publication of The Lost Garden at Research Bay, and also an industry friend, Richard Weston, who owns a farm out in Brighton. He was already importing some of the seed. And so between us, we were able to cross-reference the list that originally was purchased for the D'Entrecasteaux expedition, and we were able to come up with a list then of our own varieties that were still available that we could then plant in our garden here. We did have some quarantine issues, and of course the variety list is much reduced in the last 200 years. So we came up with a list that we felt were popular in use during France at that time.
Mm-hmm. Are there any of those vegetables used by the head chef?
Yeah, absolutely. So the produce that comes out of the French garden, we do continue to grow the Vilmorin varieties. And it becomes a part of the whole system of produce that's available for the kitchen for use. So regularly mostly at the beginning of the week, the gardeners in that production space are liaising with the kitchen about how the produce can be used, upcoming, quantities of produce, and the French garden produce becomes a part of that list as well. Mm-hmm. It's become an area as well that we can include as the gardens open up and we have more community interactions. It's also become a part of the education as well throughout the produce space.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful. So we've talked a bit about when you were promoted, the work you've done since 2019 when you became the estate gardens manager. And we've talked a little bit about preparing for climate change, now that that's really upon us. What are the issues that Hobart, being the second driest capital city in Australia, there are issues of water. What this obviously must be forefront of your mind. What's happening with the water planning?
It has been on my mind. Yeah, we've, like a lot of larger states, need to prepare ourselves for drier climates, but also a climate that presents sort of large rainfall followed by periods of drought. Something that I've been really wanting to improve during my short time as manager is improving our irrigation systems. Many of our systems were still manual operated, and also many of the systems actually didn't cover the entire area of the beds that they were intending to be. We did a lot of hand watering. We dragged a lot of hoses around to connecting sprinklers and laying soaker hoses down, which I just felt was so inadequate. They were really sort of band-aid measures, trying to get plants, trees through the sort of summer periods particularly. So we have done a lot of work extending lines, improving systems, automating systems, and getting water to areas of the garden that didn't previously have it. There are other things that I would love to be able to achieve here in the garden in terms of water storage and our use of water. We don't have any rain tanks, for instance. Our previous spring was very wet, and it would have been wonderful to be able to capture some of that water, because now in the later stages of summer heading into autumn, the garden is very dry and we're doing some heavy irrigating there. We're connected to the sort of mains town supply water for Hobart, and I think there's also room there to be able to connect into recycled water that actually travels straight past the Government House main gates. And one day it would be a bit of a dream of mine to be able to connect into that and use recycled water throughout areas of the estate that are within the requirements and usages around recycled water. I already spoke about increasing canopy cover as well, to be able to cool the site, and also increase our succession planting, goes towards, future-proofing for storms and water flow through the estate. And And also soil health more generally right through the whole estate. You know, if we can have a soil that's able to hold some of that water rather than losing it, mm-hmm. you know, that's, you know, so important as well.
Mm-hmm. Just before we move on, I'm talking about succession planning with the trees, that the very significant old trees that do reach the end of their life. Are there issues around that in terms of replacing those trees or alternative trees that are going to be more sustainable in the longer term? What happens around that? Have you had recent debates over some of the old trees?
We have a tree report that I use to program tree work throughout the estate, and it documents the health and life expectancy of many of our trees. And unfortunately, the majority of the trees that have been planted, you know, even in the last 50 years, have been those for ceremonial plantings to recognise visiting dignitaries. We've not done really the amount of planting that we should have to fill the gaps that we're going to see sort of in the next 100 years. Many of our oaks and elms in particular are, you know, 180, 160 years old. So perhaps what we're seeing and what we're experiencing now is the trees at their very best, you know, for the next 50 to 80 years. And we certainly need to be doing some more planning and you know, securing money, funding, budget to be able to do those large scale plantings that I believe we need.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another big project you're working on is redevelopment of the Quarry Pond Garden. Can you tell us a little more about that?
That was a project that's been going on for many years now, actually. It was Steve Percival, previous head gardener, who began really the large-scale weed removal in that area. There was a lot of blackberries, cotoneasters, vinca, you know, all the nasties that he started removing, and literally truckloads were taken out of there. The next head gardener, Ben Essex, he continued that project, and he started focusing more on the ornamental beds and, you know, continuing that removal of vinca and thinking about future plannings. And it was Ben that engaged local landscape architect Lindsay Campbell, who came in and offered his advice and recommendations in terms of the concepts around the planting style and subsequent planting lists that then during my time we have planted out. So there's been a lot of work. The weed removal continued. The irrigation system was completely upgraded to an automatic system. And we also had to re-establish some of the stone walls, renovate garden paths. There was also a lot of tree work that had to happen throughout that space as well. There's many old eucalypts and pines, cedars, that needed dead wooding before we could really get in there and start doing that work at the ground level, actually. And we've now planted over 1,000 new ornamentals. And the sort of continues to develop that space. There was a lot of thought about the style of planting that we should have down there, and we chose with Lindsay Campbell to recognise the earlier plantings of our Tasmanian tree ferns. So we've increased our collection of those within the plantings, and also sort of calmed down the plantings in terms of their floral showiness and chosen plants that are actually much more about their foliage colour and softening the space and perhaps drawing attention to the beautiful views rather than showy specimen plants.
Mm-hmm. So it's a whole new concept really around...
It has. I think it's really taken it back to what was intended actually, rather than the subsequent plantings that have happened. You know, so often the garden beds have been managed by many, you know, different gardeners over the years, and their own styles and tastes can be passed on to the plantings. And, you know, there was a lot of variation in the and a lot of different varieties of plants that were being grown in that space, and we've sort of simplified it a lot, reduced the amount of the plant species chosen, and really chosen to create a space that...
It seems that it's as plant a landscape design that you're drawing on the history a bit of that area too, which is wonderful. Not a, when I said a new concept, it is actually drawing on the history as well.
Absolutely, yeah. The, it was Governor World very early on was so excited and fascinated with our own Tasmanian fern species, and it was him with diary entries that were recognised by Professor Kate Warner in her writing of the history of Government House, that, you know, we chose to draw on those chronicled history, you know, and reflect that in the new planting. And it's, you know, it's wonderful for the garden to have, you know, a story and a depth behind the decisions that we're making.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Now, I want to talk a bit about Government House being open to the public and the community interest, because I look back over our Australian Garden History Society, our newsletter, Blue Gum, and in 2011, over that period, there were a series of articles, and one of them goes back in history, and it wasn't until 1989 that the public were ever allowed in Government House. So since that time, the respective governors have opened more and more frequently, and now probably this is the era where the gardens are being more widely used than ever before. Can you talk about what's the kind of community involvement at this point?
Community involvement with the garden particularly has evolved quite slowly. I think, in my opinion, it was the late Governor Peter Underwood that perhaps first talked about opening up the gardens, not only to showcase our colonial history and Government House itself, but also the opportunity for Government House to be involved in as an educational resource. And that was certainly backed up during Professor Kate Warner's time at Government House. We traditionally offered a Government House Open Day, and that was an annual event. It was decided to reduce that to a biennial event, but then include in the Government House program regular tours. And we started out with an ornamental garden tour, which was a monthly tour offered to the public. And we then extended that into more focused tours, our significant tree tour, and then also the garden produce tour. And they've all been received, you know, really well. They're very popular. They often book out prior to those tours. There was also in 2019, we intended to introduce a new event to the Government House calendar, and that was a winter series of horticultural speakers. And this was another way for Government House to connect with the gardening community of Tasmania through a series of lectures that we would host in the Government House ballroom. Unfortunately, we were hit with COVID, and it's only now this year that we're able to offer that again. So, and I do hope that, you know, into the future we can continue to do that. And I think there's room within that space to extend what Government House are doing as well. We have a huge variety of plants, of horticultural techniques that are being practiced here that we can offer perhaps sort of professional development for people already in the industry, you know, with our own staff hosting events, or, you know, offering the space for industry professionals to come here and offer educational experiences to the public. I think there's a lot of room there.
Mm-hmm.
We could
to build on Government House horticultural practices are a huge resource.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Coming back just to the day-to-day world of working in this garden, do you have a favourite time of the year of this, of being in the garden?
Favourite time of the year? We're just now heading into autumn, and I do love this time of the year. It feels the sort of pressure of summer and keeping up with the maintenance slows down. I love the changing of the autumn colour throughout the garden, and we have wonderful shared backdrop looking over to the north to the botanical gardens. There's, you know, a stillness in the garden in autumn that I love, and looking over the river, you know, some days it can be, it's a beautiful, you know, it's beautiful views, you know, right through the estuary. Springtime is incredibly vibrant. It's the gardens, beds are full of colour, and yeah, leading into spring and into summer, we've got, you know, magnolias and camellias flowering and lots of bulbs coming, sort of emerging through the garden beds as well. So that's an incredibly vibrant time. But I think if I was to think about my favourite time, it's probably now, as the garden sort of becomes quieter and we lead into that sort of slumber of winter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's so often the favourite time. Seasons of mist and mellow fruitfulness.
Yes. Yeah.
The famous poem. Coming to talking, you talked about the botanic gardens. What is there a close relationship between Government House and the botanic gardens? How does that work?
Both organisations are actually quite separate in that they're managed by different departments. But of course, you know, they're our neighbours, and we do have some interactions with. We often buy plants from them through their the plant stalls that they have, and their tomato sales, particularly sort of at the beginning of the growing season. I go to their managers for advice about management of the garden here also. And only recently we've decided to have a co-hosted garden tour event, which will include the Royal Botanical Gardens French Reconciliation Garden, and it will lead into our La Haye's garden produce area. So that will be the first time that I'm aware that we've collaborated on a tour program.
It sounds exciting.
Yeah.
There might be the beginning of many more.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. Finally, I suppose, Tara, I want to ask you whether there's anything else you wanted to cover, and then I want to ask about your own garden at home, which I gather is totally different. But tell me, are there any other areas you would like to add to our conversation?
I think if I look forward to the future of the gardens, you know, we have to encourage greater community interactions, and I hope that we can continue to develop our tour programs and the types of experiences that Government House can offer. It's a, you know, that community appreciation of the gardens will go such a long way towards the conservation of the estate as a whole. And yeah, I really hope that we can continue to encourage more people to Government House, and it becomes perhaps part of their own life stories, you know, visiting Government House regularly. And it's, you know, I think it's still in some ways seen as a closed space that only sort of dignitaries visit. And I really hope we can expand that opinion of the gardens. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Make it much more accessible.
Yeah.
Because you're right, in the long term, if more people know and understand and appreciate, they're more likely to want to support.
Absolutely.
The garden being financially able to be supported long term. Mm. Now come to your garden, your home garden, having the great responsibility of looking after a historic garden, and then what do you have at home?
So my garden is quite a contrast to the estate garden here at Government House. Our house is a cottage built in the 1960s, and my family and I, we sort of love the aesthetic of sort of mid-century modern design, and I think we've reflected that in the way that we've redesigned the garden, introducing lots of sort of gravel gardens and rocks in the landscaping, and also a lot of ornamental grasses, succulents, and even cactuses. I love that sort of that desert modern aesthetic, but I'm not restrained enough to be able to fully align the garden with that. I'm too tempted at the nurseries to buy more and more.
Yeah. And have a great diversity instead.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, we're in Richmond. It's, you know, it's an arid zone to grow, you know, a garden. And we're, you know, influenced by very dry summers and very cold, frosty winters. And I think that, you know, it suits the palette, the plant selection that I've chosen. And, you know, maybe it's a way that, you know, Australian gardens will move, you know, rather than showcasing perhaps European style spring gardens, you know, maybe we'll recognise the aesthetic beauty of a late summer garden.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that is going to be the future, given climate change, less water, more extremes.
Yeah.
We're going to see different kinds of gardens. Well, thank you so much, Tara, for your time and contributing to our oral history program.
Thanks again.